I just didn't know. Some you dial conference code, and then you dial a code if you're the moderator. Hello, Stag Numenton. Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Cheryl,
Stag? Stag Newman's on. Cheryl's asked me to moderate.
Okay.
Okay, great.
This is Dr. Gillis?
This is Dr. Gillis.
Okay.
Thank you very much for being...
Okay, that sounds like Anna Ella.
Tonight. It is.
And who else do we have right now?
I haven't heard any other beeps, but...
Okay, Cheryl's just about to pick up. I think Cheryl is joining.
Yes.
We'll give a couple minutes. Usually if people aren't totally prompt. I know, unfortunately, Ann Stewart can't join, but she's looking forward to listening to it on the video replay as soon as she can. She had a...
Audio replay,
I mean. and by the way, Jake is... Carrie was up here last Thursday working on all our horses, and he was very pleased with how Jake was... has come along.
Great. That's good. Indeed.
You know, what his diagnostics said. Now, obviously, the ultimate test is going to be when we get him down there at ultrasound. But he's overall being a good patient. We haven't totally... only thing that concerns us is he occasionally likes...
just joined.
Yeah.
John Marsh.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
Glad you're on.
Thanks.
We're just sort of chit-chatting. We had... John, for your background, I think Ann Ayala knows this. One of our horses had been having some chronic off-and-on back problems, particularly after a spill on a ride down to Florida. And so we had him to Dr. Gillis, and we're rigorously following her program, and he seems to be making very good progress. So I was just letting her know that. Sounds like we had one or two other people join.
Yeah, Rick Wasner here.
Hey, Rick, how are you doing?
Hey, Rick.
Very good.
And was there another beep in there?
Okay. That's her too, but...
I thought it was a drop.
Okay, well, it's... Okay. Hopefully not. okay, so let's wait one more minute, and then we'll go ahead and get started. And...
Stag, were you at the Big South Fork this weekend?
Yes. Who just joined?
Hello, I'm back.
Okay.
Sorry.
We did lose you. Yeah, we were there. Cheryl got first place in the 64-mile ride.
Great.
Whatever that means.
I'm Josie. She and Josie were the 55 and the 30 completed. She and Josie were leading the 100 when they called it. It went from very cold, cold rain, mud, et cetera, to very hot, humid, sunny, and then the real storm came through.
No, boy.
And trees were down everywhere, and so ride management wisely said, you know, you can't send riders out in 100 and at nighttime when you don't have any idea whether. Where the trees are down over the trails and all that. So
all right.
Unfortunately, the 100 got shortened. But I think essentially all the riders were rather happy.
Yeah.
As it was.
Had enough of mud and rain.
Yeah.
And it looked like some kind of nasty storms that came through.
And Cheryl and Josie had another obstacle. Cheryl rounded a corner, and there was a bear 10 feet in front of them.
Oh, whoopee.
Fortunately, all three said yipes and then went their own separate ways.
Oh. Yeah.
Is this the first year they've offered 100, or was it a two-day 50 or a two-day 50?
No, they've had 100 for several years, because we did it 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And it's a good, tough 100.
Paying attention, but...
Not quite as tough as OD, but close.
There's a lot of climbing in that, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, why don't we get started? Cheryl, I think, sent around Dr. Gillis's... resume and credentials and all, but we're delighted, Dr. Gillis, that you're joining us. And we are, as I was mentioning earlier, we have one of our horses rigorously following her regimen after both Carrie Ridgway and Ann Stewart had recommended we go down there because he has with having back problems that weren't healing. And sure enough, he had dorsal sacral ligament tear, but Dr. Gillis is leading the research in the entire area of basically ligament, tendon, ultrasound diagnosis, and healing. And another veterinarian I respect, Dr. Trish Dowling, who was at the Big Fork, South Fork ride, told us, people follow her regimen, they get good success, do it. So that's another question. So maybe with that as a brief introduction, I'll just turn it over to Dr. Gillis, who's done, what, over 25,000 ultrasounds, I think.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you for that introduction and vote of confidence since you're having to do this rehab program yourself. It's always a test of faith, but we do have a good success rate if we can get horse and rider through the rehab program. So would it be better for me to go through our topic list initially and then open to questions, or do people have questions right off the bat?
Go through the topic list. If people have questions during that, you know, if you don't mind taking that then, or we'll just open it up for questions then, whichever way you prefer.
Sure. That would be great. Well, I think ultrasound has held my attention for quite a number of years because it was the opposite side of the page to radiographs. Now, we'd always been able to radiograph hard tissue since I'd been a veterinarian. I was lucky enough to have that available. But if we were unable to diagnose an injury using radiographs, we were kind of up a creek. We could use our fingers and our eyes, which are, you know, that's always good. Watch the horse move, palpate, listen to the history, and observe. But it was very tricky because soft tissue injuries, and soft tissue means tendon, ligament, muscle, have a short, relatively short inflammatory phase, which lasts about 3 or 4 weeks, and a relatively long healing phase, which lasts about 8 months. So we would rest the horses and maybe give it anti-inflammatory medication if needed for comfort, and very quickly the horse would be comfortable, but we weren't really sure how much work the horse could do. The clinical signs would abate, but healing hadn't really gotten started. And in those times, we weren't sure how long the healing phases were. We've discovered that since with the aid of ultrasound. So it was kind of a trial and error sort of a thing where people would say, well, can I trot the horse? And we'd say, okay, go for it. And oops, that didn't work out well. So when diagnostic ultrasound became available in about 1982, a few pioneering people were using it. I just thought that was fantastic that we could visualize soft tissues and we could actually see the tears and then we could actually observe them healing. So that's when my interest started. And at that time, we really felt that most tendon injuries were that single bad step. But we've since learned that most tendon or ligament, when I say tendon, I'll include tendon and ligament together. Muscle is slightly different. Muscle heals a little faster, but the mechanism of injury is about the same. Most soft tissue injuries are repetitive injuries. They're tendons and ligaments are like steel cables. You tear a few fibers, then they're slightly weakened, and you continue in work, and you tear a few more fibers, and they're slightly more weakened, and so on. So it's usually a gradual, incremental type of injury rather than the one-time bad step or one-time trauma. Certainly, horses can have a fall or hit an obstacle or be kicked or injured and have a traumatic injury, but it is the minority of the time, the majority of the time. This is a creeping kind of injury, and the more adept we get at detecting the clinical and ultrasonographic signs, the earlier we can stop and treat the horse appropriately, and the faster the rehab is and the easier it is to have a good outcome. So ultrasound has really helped us not only be able to visualize soft tissues, but be able to understand what's going on with them and to detect injury early. The best ways to avoid an injury, the simplest way to to avoid injury is to condition properly, and that is a combination of art and science, and it's certainly an individual thing from horse to horse, but proper conditioning helps prevent fatigue. Muscles help control tendon stretching and loading, because tendons are attached to a muscle. It goes muscle, tendon, bone as a unit. So when the muscles become fatigued, they don't contract as precisely as they do when they are healthy and normal and not tired, and they start loading the tendons inappropriately. And so the horse takes a little bit of a tiny bit of a jerky step or an unlevel step, improper loading, and repeated over hundreds or thousands of times, that is wearing on the tendon or ligament. Ligament is a bone-to-bone unit, but it has muscle tissue within it. So the same sort of thing applies. Fatigue is a big issue. So conditioning is very, very critical, and there can be too little conditioning. The weekend warrior, the horse who hangs out in pasture all week and then suddenly is asked to go on a long ride or a strenuous ride, a ride on the sand or deep going or hills or some sort of strenuous work, and the horse gets tired. The other kind of conditioning, the other end of the spectrum, is too much conditioning, repetitive motion. Think of the tennis player who gets tennis elbow because he hits the ball 10,000 times in practice as well as in competition. So the art comes in when knowing when your horse is fit enough but not overtraining. Certainly performing the same repetitive motion is hard. Again, the tennis elbow on these structures. So when a horse is being conditioned, giving the horse frequent short breaks to allow a little muscle relaxation and a little rest is very, very important. The other part of conditioning is increasing work amount too quickly. Some horses can progress and work more quickly than others, and again, that's a judgment call. Paying attention to your particular horse, using general guidelines, but also observing the horse closely for signs that he or she may need to be conditioned a little more slowly and gradually, or that the horse is that superior athlete who can go a little more quickly than the average. The value of a proper warm-up in prevention was based on some research that I did at UC Davis when I was doing my doctoral studies in tendon pathology. A 15 to 20 minute walk warm-up, 15 being the absolute minimum, pre-stretches tendons. It also lubricates joints. And I found that in experimental cadaver limbs, horses, we were fortunate enough at Davis to have a fabulous research program, because horses that died at the racetrack for any reason were in Northern California were all given a full autopsy at UC Davis. So we had plenty of cadaver limbs. So I was able to put those in a mechanical testing device and measure strain on the tendons and ligaments and also measure load to rupture of tendons and ligaments, and then do some more fine-tuned studies where we didn't rupture to load. But one of the early things that we discovered was that if we walked the limb for 15 to 20 minutes prior to faster work, the tendons and ligaments ruptured at a much higher load. So we started to realize the value of pre-stretching. So one of the golden habits to get into when conditioning horses is that walk warm-up. I've gone through a few of our topic categories. Why don't I have a pause there and see if anyone has comments or questions?
One thing related to somewhat to, in some sense, prevention that I've been thinking about in our endurance horses and just our own very small sample, and particularly Jake, who's the horse, of course, we're going through rehab, is how important is it for a horse when they're really young, you know, say, you know, from 0 up to 3 or 4 years old, to really be out running like a horse would in the wild, and therefore developing the strength in a lot of these soft tissues, that so that when you then put them into serious training, they're ready for it. Because, you know, just thinking, you know, we don't know Jake's background, his rescue horse, but we put the pieces together, we suspect he was raised like a show Arab, and therefore probably didn't get the same early stress, and are, and I'm sort of assuming these tissues are most adaptable when the horses are young and all. Is that, should that be an important consideration for us, that if we get a horse that didn't go through that early stress, then we actually have to be much more careful?
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. We know that to be quite true in racehorses, that horses that do grow up in a herd, in a group, in a pasture situation, are much more precocious and seem to be quite a bit more sturdy. Horses are adapting very rapidly from 0 to 3, even from 0 to 2 years, and their bone mass responds to galloping freely. They seem to develop, their cardiovascular system develops, their respiratory system develops, as well as their musculoskeletal system. So it is more likely the horse that's grown up in a pasture situation with a group of horses, other young horses specifically, that it runs and plays with and exercises freely with as a young animal, is more likely to have an easy time adapting to athletic stress and be more amenable to conditioning and less likely to have difficulties with conditioning. There has been some research doing forced exercise in very young horses, yearlings, and some controversial results that some people showed a positive effect to having very young horses exercise on a treadmill or on a Eurosizer, and this is 6 months to a year or even 4 months to 16 months or a couple of the studies. But other people have shown that that may be detrimental. So I think the safest answer at this point, until we get some more information on those topics, is that the ideal situation for a young horse is to be growing up in a pasture situation with other young horses, so that they're encouraged to run and play and use their bodies as much as possible in a healthy way.
And I have a question of going back to the repetitive stress versus traumatic stress causative. Are certain tendons, ligaments, whatever you want to call it, more prone to call it breaking under one type of stress versus the other? In particular, I know my horse popped a curb a couple of years ago, and I understood at the time that it was something that was more likely to be traumatic stress to have caused it rather than repetitive stress. And at the same time, I never, you know, traumatic stress one step to the next. I just didn't quite make it because I never felt him go off dramatically from one step to the next. And so are certain of the tissues more, if they're going to have a problem, more likely to be susceptible to one flavor of stress versus another?
Yes and no. The flexor tendons on the backs of the limbs are generally, they're not as well supported by the bony column of the limb. The extensor tendons on the front of the limb are on the side of the limb where they get more bony column support. So the extensor tendons are somewhat shielded from repetitive stress, but prone to traumatic stress. The horse that hits the extensor tendons on a fence or, you know, when jumping or hits an obstacle of any kind on a trail or that sort of thing. Having said that, extensor tendon injuries are far less common than flexor tendon injuries. The long plantar ligament, which you're describing with the curb, can be a traumatic, you know, a kicking incident, that sort of thing. There's usually a mark or a wound, but not always. The long plantar ligament is a very short ligament that basically stops the tarsal bones from moving backwards. It's not a true weight-bearing ligament. It's more of a stabilizing ligament. So conformation can play a role. Horses that are a little bit cow-hocked, that tend to to have a sharp angle to their hock, and with their feet, when they're standing, their feet are a little bit forward underneath their belly, seem to be more prone to curb. But curb is not a terribly common injury except in standardbred racehorses, which is interesting, which standardbreds tend to have quite a few or higher incidence of curb. But overall, that's, curb is not a common injury in the general horse population.
Interesting.
That help answer your question?
Yeah. It sort of puts it in perspective on which, where to look, at least on leg types of things.
Yeah. And no, there is no such thing as a perfect horse on the topic of conformation. I do, when I'm looking at a horse, you know, helping someone select a horse to buy, I look for a horse, you know, all the classic conformational advice, you know, is real. You know, you want a horse that's balanced, you know, neck, trunk, and croup as much as possible. A short back, a short, strong back is less prone to back injury. Horses have sort of hinges in their back. The cervical or neck spine is very mobile. The thoracic or chest spine is fairly mobile, so the horse can breathe and turn. The lumbar spine is less mobile, so there's sort of a hinge between the thorax and the lumbar area, the thoracolumbar junction. And then the sacral spine is not very mobile. It's a plate. It has some mobility, but not within itself particularly. So the lumbosacral junction is another hinge, if you will. So you want a fairly short back and a fairly extensive croup to give yourself, to give the horse balance for strength. I certainly am wary of horses that are back at the knee. Those horses tend to have more flexor tendon problems and have a harder time healing from them when they do have the problem. Horses that are very straight behind tend to have hind suspensory problems, which is a tricky injury to heal, although doable. Horses that tend to want to have straight, long straight pasterns and low heels, have a broken back hoof pastern axis, have also put a lot of strain on the flexors in their pasterns, and that's certainly an endurance horse consideration. Endurance horses are prone to pastern injuries just because of their job. They do a lot of twisting and turning on often uneven ground, and they really torque the ligaments in their pasterns. So I see a disproportionate number of pastern injuries in endurance horses. So looking for a short, strong pastern and a horse that wants to grow his hoof aligned with his pastern, so you're not always fighting his natural tendencies to keep that pastern hoof alignment, is a good choice for an endurance horse, all other things being equal. Arabs, Arabians are horses we see frequently, of course, as endurance horses, and they tend to have very good feet in general, and they often have a nice foot shape to go with that strong, hard hoof. So that is helpful, and I would look warily a little bit at a horse that did not have that advantage. Comments on conformation or questions?
John?
I'm wondering whether I've got the good horse.
You're going to go run outside and look. Wait a minute.
Well, I guess I was going to follow up. I guess it may be coming later, too, but I guess my first question really was, are there specific pieces of the anatomy that are much more frequently affected by the kind of repetitive injuries that you see in endurance? And I guess you just kind of answered that, focused on the pastern, but maybe there's other. And we haven't gotten to the section about diagnosis, but it's, you know, the real question for me is, you know, how do you kind of identify this early enough to do something before it comes serious?
We can talk about that and go back to where injury, we kind of started to go over where injuries can occur. That is one other thing that was a key piece of information that I acquired while I was doing my doctorate, was that we've done a lot of sort of questionable things to horses over the centuries, as horsemen and as veterinarians, in the name of tendon and ligament having poor blood supply, or the lower limb of the horse having poor blood supply, that's not the case. Tendon and ligament have perfectly adequate blood supply. What they seem to be somewhat lacking in, from looking at many hundreds of cross-section histopath slides, is nerve supply. So tendon and ligament don't have a good early warning system. Usually by the time you think you have a tendon or ligament injury, you almost certainly do. Once someone has had one and rehabbed a horse, they get much more picky about looking at their horses. Certainly by the time a horse is lame at a trot on the straight, they have an injury, you know, and it's attributed to a soft tissue. They have a soft tissue injury, or lame on a circle at a trot. You're going to have a real injury there when you look on ultrasound. What I find to be more sensitive than watching the horse move, although I certainly do watch the horse move, is palpation. If you get in the habit when you're tacking your horse up in a quiet spot where he's paying attention to you, but he's relaxed and comfortable, of running your hands just over his body while you're brushing, just and having a feel down each limb, you can be his early warning system for tendon and ligament injuries. Pain, heat, and swelling will occur before lameness at the trot, and it can be very small. It can be very focal. I usually recommend when people are cleaning their horse's feet to just have that limb comfortably flexed. They're more sensitive to palpation when the limb is flexed, and run your hands down the flexor tendons. Good to familiarize yourself in at least on a fairly simplistic and basic way, but thorough as far as what those tendons and ligaments are. There's tons of good anatomy books out that can, and just think to yourself, rather than just running your hand down the leg, think to yourself, superficial flexor tendon, deep flexor tendon, suspensory ligament, check ligament, and so forth, and just run your hand down those structures. And a lot of horses will jump away from you when they're not used to you doing that. But if you get your horse accustomed to that, so they're relaxed, and don't give you a false positive, that can become a very accurate diagnostic aid. So distal limbs, right down to the feet, check each hoof for warmth. You can do this, walk around the whole horse in 5 minutes and have a feel over his surface area. Just looking for those things, slight swelling, warmth, jumping away from you abnormally when you're palpating them. And the other thing is running your hands down the horse's back. The other common place that endurance horses do have injuries is back, because, again, they're going long distances, lots of times over challenging terrain, and those back hinges and back ligaments get tested pretty hard. So just standing on the left side of the horse, putting your hands flat on their withers, just on either side of their spine, and just evenly, firmly pressing, not with the tips of your fingers, but the flat of your hand down each side from withers to tailhead is a really good way to get your horse used to that and for you to get used to his response, so that if you have an abnormal response, you know right away. I'm not a big beefy person, and I can do this pretty accurately with horses. You don't need to be you don't need to palpate hard. You just need to use a medium firm touch to do that sort of palpation. And those are easy things you can do when you're grooming and tacking up. And that will show you a positive response before the trot up does.
I've tried to do that on occasion when I first bring the horse in and groom him, as you suggest, and I get a reaction sometimes. And then I go back 5 minutes later and try again, and I get nothing.
And you're doing exactly the right thing. I usually just sort of walk around the horse, test the other leg, and go back and forth a time or two. And horses will just sort of idly pull away from you. Horses really sore kind of gives you an ouch. It's
right.
not just a stop squeezing on my leg kind of a flicker. They give you they contract their muscles. If someone else is watching the horse, they'll actually see their triceps muscles, their forearm muscles, just above their elbow, contract. So those are things you can do that you can see. But you do have to just kind of do it repetitively. Start from a baseline and do it repetitively. So the horse gets pretty, isn't inattentive, but is fairly nonchalant about it, so that if they're not, you can be immediately a little suspicious.
Right. Well, you establish your baseline.
Yeah.
What you're saying.
Yeah, because horses, you know, really vary, just like people, from fairly sensitive to fairly stoic. And so knowing kind of which end of the range a horse falls in is a very helpful piece of information.
And Rick, do you have any questions too, Rick Wasner?
Oh, I just following along here. Find it very interesting.
And how about Ann?
I'm good right at the moment, thank you.
Okay.
But chewing on this information for the moment.
Right.
Okay. We've kind of gone over where injuries tend to occur. And you know, as I was saying, pastern and collateral ligaments. Every joint in the horse has ligaments on the sides to help stabilize the bones, front and back, but also on each side. And endurance horses are prone to injuries on the sides of their pasterns. And again, it's that twisting, turning, uneven ground, landing unevenly. The hocks have those ligaments, the knees have those ligaments, the carpi, fetlock and the pasterns right down to the coffin joint has collateral ligaments. So, and as I say, they're side-to-side stabilizers. So that's an area that's, you know, don't just palpate the front and back of the horse's limb, just do a 360 feel. Lots of times, too, if you're in doubt, if there's swelling, you hopefully got a normal leg on the other side to compare to. These injuries can be bilateral, can affect both limbs, but don't usually. More often, they're a one limb or another. And the way we as veterinarians diagnose them when they're injured is the same way I'm suggesting to you. We use palpation. It's a practice thing. Definitely your fingers get more skilled. It's just like learning a sport. The more of it you do, the more sensitive your fingers get, especially if you're thinking to yourself, okay, collateral ligaments. Your brain gets more information out of it if it names the structure and thinks specifically about what you're palpating. So having taught many, 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 many veterinary students how to do this, I know that this is something that it does take practice, but it's pretty straightforward to do. A little basic knowledge of anatomy and repeated palpation is very, very helpful. We do usually do flexion tests. Flexion tests have been an old standby for veterinary medicine. Now they're being called into question, but I think a properly done flexion test where you're not going crazy with your flexion, but you're just putting that joint under some tension for 90 seconds is very, very helpful, doing that and then trotting the horse off. I do the hind suspensory. I have a separate exam to help separate out the hind suspensory from hock issues, because I see a lot of horses that have had their hocks injected for 2 years for a hind suspensory injury. And the classic history with that is a horse is having his hocks injected every 6 months, and then suddenly one hock needs to be done every 3 months, and then suddenly it's down to 6 weeks, and that's usually when I see them. The problem there is that the hock joints, the pouches of the hock joints, drape over the origin of the hind suspensory. So when you inject, if you either block or inject the joint, the whatever you're injecting often bathes the fibers at the origin of the suspensory. It diffuses across. So you can either block the origin of the hind suspensory with a hock block, or if you're injecting steroids into the hock, you can put some steroids over the origin of the suspensory and quiet down inflammation. So what I usually do, a classic hock flexion test where I like the horse's croup to be level. I don't like him to look like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I try to bend my own back and keep the horse level, but I do put the hock under flexion, trot them off. But then I just ask the horse to rest the toe of his hind limb on the ground with his heel off the ground, get him comfortable there, and then reach around under the horse's chestnut. That's where the suspensory origin can be palpated, and I just palpate that quite firmly for 90 seconds, leaving the toe on the ground, and then ask the horse to trot off and see if I get a more positive response to that than I do to hock flexion. If I do, I'm very, very suspicious of a high suspensory injury. So that is one special flexion test, I think, working around the horse. The one other thing that does happen to endurance horses somewhat frequently is they get kicked in the shoulder. Competing in a group, one horse can get a bit close to another horse who decides to object to it and nails them in the shoulder, on the point of the shoulder. And the biceps tendon runs right over the point of the shoulder. It's an extensor of the forelimb. And the biceps, there's a bursa between the tendon and the humerus to let the tendon glide smoothly over the humerus. So you can get an inflamed bicipital bursa, or you can have actual tendon injury. And usually just walking around the horse, if they have a very short, mostly those horses have a very short stride. The cranial face, they're not hiking lame, they just have a very short stride. They don't tilt over, but they don't step out. And those horses are usually sore when you palpate the point of their shoulder. The caveat with that is almost every horse will move away from you when you palpate their shoulders and their stifles. So you have to do comparison left and right. But those are diagnostic tools that we use a lot in conjunction with the back palpation that I described. Horses do get neck joint arthritis, so checking the horse for neck flexibility with the horse should be able to, if you're standing at his shoulder, put his nose in your pocket on either side and bend down and upward without any sign of distress. So that's another test that we do to check for comfort in the horse. The usual history with soft tissue injury is chronic low-grade intermittent lameness. The horse is usually lame after hard work or a competition. 2 or 3 days of rest, ice, butte, and the horse looks a whole lot better, may look sound, may require flexion tests or lunging on a circle. Usually horses will show a bit more soft tissue lameness on the circle. To pick up lameness after a few days. So this can be excused as stepped on a rock or whatever, pulled a muscle a little bit. And I see lots of horses that have had those signs for months or even years. Soft tissue injuries, I think, are more a cause of loss of use, poor performance, wastage of horses in that way than outright lameness. And the horse with a soft tissue injury is a horse that showed a lot of potential as a young horse but never fulfilled that potential over the last few years, or a horse that was arcing upward in their sports trajectory and then flattened out or even started to tail off. And that's more the common history that I get than outright lameness. Some people will tell me this horse has never been really lame, but he's never been really right either. He's just somewhere in between. He doesn't feel comfortable and strong and confident. So tendons, I think, are a very insidious cause of lameness. And when I say tendons, I mean tendon and ligament. Muscle damage is usually more readily apparent. Muscle has big mass. It's usually hot and swollen when it's injured. And muscle tends to heal. It has a higher metabolic rate than tendon or ligament, which have a low metabolic rate and heal quite slowly. Tendon or ligament injury might take 8 months to heal, whereas a muscle injury could heal in 4 months. More like a fracture, actually. Bone is a higher metabolic rate than tendon or ligament as well. So faster healing time for muscle and more dramatic signs. So it's tendon and ligament that are a little more tricky to diagnose, often are missed until they're quite chronic and then take quite a while to heal. They're never a short healing time, but the more chronic they are, the longer time you're looking at to get them to resolve. Questions or comments on that section?
So muscles, you're saying, typically heal in about half the time of tendons or ligaments.
Yes.
And that for many of the muscles, it's more obvious because you'll see heat and swelling. How about... I know Carrie has been saying that a lot of our horses may be having psoas issues, which obviously we aren't going to see because it's so deep in there.
Right, right.
What's your feeling on that as one of our chronic problems?
I think it is a cause of chronic problems, and it's probably seriously underdiagnosed because I just really realized recently that we can, there's a small window where we can evaluate the psoas muscle, certainly not all of it, but we can look at it in the flank and see at least a short section of the psoas and give ourselves some inkling of its health as a muscle. But I think it requires, you know, some special maneuvers, some of, for instance, Carrie's, you know, psoas stretch to see if a horse will respond to that, if they just have a tight muscle or a slightly inflamed muscle. He's finding that the horses that just don't respond to his manipulation and stretching are, we're finding that when we look at those horses, some of them do have deep muscle tears. But those are, those, that's one of our deeper muscles that we have to deal with, along with some of the biceps femoris, multiple heads that are quite deep, that are require very deep specialized palpation to elicit a response.
Do muscles, I mean, one of the things which I may be getting slightly ahead, when you talk about rehabilitation of ligaments and tendons, well, let me state the question, and then when, after you talk about that, also talk about muscles is what the program is for rehabilitation for muscles as contrasted with ligaments and tendons. But
yeah.
I think I've gotten slightly ahead of the storyline.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Question,
sure.
I guess, where we're here. Is there, other than kind of every time you see the horse, you know, running their legs, and is there something that's a little more, I'm not sure what the word would be, sophisticated, I guess, maybe your ultrasound or something, something that you might recommend be done with some cause kind of regularly, like once a year or when you start a season or something? The reason I'm asking that is we've, you know, a couple of years ago with the Apex Clinic, we x-rayed the front feet. And since then, I've been doing it every year, every spring, to make sure that the shoeing's still going the way we want it.
Right.
Is there something that would be recommended?
Not really.
Detect these things either before the season or during the season or after the season? Or?
Yeah, the only way that you would detect them would be ultrasound. Ultrasound takes images of a very small region at each time. That's one of the reasons it's a painstaking type of examining technique, although it's highly detailed and very, very sensitive and very specific. It takes a while to cover a small area on the horse, so if you were going to try to cover all the suspect areas in a horse, you'd be there a very long time.
So you really have a reason to go to some piece of the anatomy to do something like that.
Right, exactly. So,
okay.
You know, what I would say is become very familiar with your horse, with your fingers and eyes, and if you're suspicious at all, then that's the time to examine that spot.
Okay.
I have done, you know, pre-purchase exam ultrasounds of all four limbs, but actually under duress and protest, because I think really within an absence of clinical signs, that's probably not the wisest way to spend your money.
Got it. Okay.
So people get so worried once they rehab the soft tissue injury that they don't want to buy another horse with one. So they want to do a pre-purchase evaluation. But I really think that, you know, the clinical evaluation is the key there.
Okay.
So.
Very good. I thought that'd be your answer, but I just wanted to check.
Yeah.
Let me ask a slight variation of that, though, because it actually came up this weekend when I was discussing, you know, basically what we were learning with some of the riders at Big South Fork. And somebody was asking my opinion of when you're looking for an endurance Arab, and you know, I repeated, you know, my experience says look for one that was, you know, ranch race, so to speak, you know, running around with other horses when they're young, like we talked about. Or I said, get one that, you know, has come off the track sound. Okay, in other words, that one's really been tested, right? If it's been raced a lot and it's still sound. And the person I was talking to, actually this was before this weekend, because this is another person that, you know, has been working with you, who had a racehorse that had repetitive injuries, and her comment was, well, before I ever got a racehorse again, I would want to have the back ultrasound. What is your feeling if one is wanting to use an Arab racing horse as an endurance prospect, would you actually just rely on somebody who's a very good clinical diagnostician there, or?
Yeah, I would. I would go with someone who does a very, very specific and thorough clinical examination, and then if they had any questions at all, follow it up with diagnostic imaging, whether that was radiographs or ultrasound or whatever was indicated. But I would go with the clinical exam as my baseline.
And I guess part of the key there is to find somebody who,
yes,
really knows what they're doing. Somebody like,
yes,
Mr. Ridgway or who has lost.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And they're your backup person. I mean, I think it's a topic of lifelong interest, looking for the sound horse for all of us. But I think as part of competition, developing your eye to the maximum, so you pre-screen a lot of these horses. Have a dispassionate look at them before you become emotionally involved with them, and run your eye over them. One of the best pieces of advice that one of the surgeons at Davis gave me while I was a student still is stand back and look at the horse first. Look at the horse from a distance, from front, back, sides, and just let your eye settle on the horse and look at the balance, look at the way the horse is standing, look at the way the horse is holding itself, look at its proportion, as well as looking for conformational faults. But the horse will give you a lot of information about how comfortable it is and how strong it is just by its stance. And you can get a lot of information before you close in on them and start looking at specific areas of their physique. So it's just a great piece of advice to just practice running your eye over horses whenever you're around a group of them, and kind of store that information with how good an athlete that horse turns out to be, in that competition or over time, and your brain starts to put that together with, okay, a horse that looks like that, stands like that, moves like that is a good athlete. And I would say most of you or all of you already are doing this consciously or unconsciously, but just taking it to the next level and thinking about it a little more specifically can save you doing 20 pre-purchase exams. You can get down to 3 probably. So find that horse that really suits you and whose imperfections are imperfections that aren't going to hold you back in your sport. Because there just is no perfect horse. They always have something, but a lot of things you can live with and some things you can't. So after you discuss all their deviations from perfect, then you look at the list and go, okay, is this list significant to me and what I want to do for this with this horse, or not so much? So, and I think that's a better way to do a pre-purchase exam than to say yes, this horse is perfect, or no, they're not. And that would certainly apply to the racehorse who's withstood the rigors. He might have a knot here and a ding there, but if they're not involving, not going to affect their soundness for your purpose, then they're probably a good choice. We used nuclear scintigraphy for a while as a screening technique, and it is. It's you're injecting radioactive dye into the horse, so you're going to some expense. They have to be quarantined for 24 hours to clear that radioactive dye. And it's certainly open to some interpretation. It can show you the hot spots on that horse, and it can be a useful diagnostic tool. Whether it should be a screening tool or not, I guess I would, again, go back to that clinical exam and want to see some clinical signs associated with the diagnostic imaging findings. So again, it comes down to you and your good clinical exam veterinarian.
Yeah, and is there, thinking about this, I mentally have perhaps an incorrect order of what you look if you've got a clinician who's looking at your horse and, you know, there's something wrong, and that's about as, that's where you're starting, but you're not quite sure what, how, or anything else, and assuming it's a limb of some sort or another, what's the, I guess the order of events is you look at it, you palpate it, you flex it. Is that right? And then you start thinking about, okay, what else?
Yeah. I think watching the horse move, palpating and doing flexion tests almost all of the time is going to point you in one or more spots that are fairly specific. You know, there's certainly plenty of horses who have more than one problem. And so the trick is keeping an open mind and making sure that when you get one problem pinned down, you don't ignore the next one that crops up. So it's ideal to identify and treat all of them simultaneously. Nerve blocks are a great example of that. If you're working, if the horse has a front end lameness and he blocks out, say, to his fetlock, but you trot the horse and he's not going perfectly evenly, you'll need to find out where else that horse is sore. He might have a fetlock collateral ligament injury and some heel pain in his other front foot, or sore back, or more than one thing going on. So again, it's that very thorough and careful clinical examination that stands you in good stead there.
And I think you said, let me make sure I understood it correctly, something very important, because that one is, like, if you're evaluating the horse, the conformation, but then I've tend to leap to the dynamic evaluation, how's the horse move, trot out, et cetera, and always put a strong emphasis on that, including, evaluating the horse's athletic ability. But I think what I heard you said is, importantly, observe the horse from a distance. So you're not really looking at conformation as much as how the horse is holding himself standing, in effect, whether he's protecting himself from pain or from chronic problems or whatever. So you're doing a static evaluation, but not of the classic conformation as much as the, what the horse is telling you from the way he's standing. Is that, did I get that right?
Yeah, and it's sort of an approach kind of a thing. Walking up to the horse, just start observing the horse from a distance. Look at his attitude, look at his stance, and then, get a little closer. Now you're kind of looking at their overall body shape, and then just getting closer and more detailed. But certainly as veterinarians, we tend to rush over to the knot on the fetlock. And I think, just proceeding a little more slowly and looking at the whole horse as a whole horse is much more productive and gives you a better idea of what the whole horse looks like. And and certainly observing the horse in motion as well. But at the very beginning of the exam, that would be to me the most logical approach is to look at the horse as a whole. And then gradually focus in on more and more specific areas of the horse. And that's the standing examination. Certainly you do watch the horse in motion as well. When you're looking for a soft tissue injury rather than, say, a horse as a prospect, now you've got a horse that you're suspicious of an injury, that's where palpation becomes very, very important, because horses are very sensitive to palpation and more likely to give you an accurate positive response palpating than observing them at the trot for soft tissue injuries. Certainly you want to watch the horse in motion as well to round out the exam.
Is there any value in watching the horse being ridden?
In some cases, there is. Some horses will show you back pain when the rider up, and they won't without a rider up. So, if the situation is not becoming clear with outer rider up, then certainly it's time to put tack on and ride the horse and evaluate the horse then. And certainly we're kind of going back and forth between two topics. Certainly, you know, a pre-purchase exam, it's good to watch how the horse moves with the rider up.
How does thermography fit into the picture of
diagnosis? Thermography can be a very useful tool. It's been used, you know, we always want to simplify things. So people want to do thermography in a sort of a rapid scan, but and thermography can be very useful because what it's doing is showing you heat.
Heat,
so,
right.
The problem is it's very sensitive, and that's the good thing, too. So what it means is you have to have the horse in an area where they don't have sunlight on one side or a breeze on the other side that heats or cools, because that can affect the outcome of the thermography. And usually you want the horse in the environment where you're going to use thermography for 30 minutes before you perform the exam. So under a specific set of circumstances, an area where there is no unidirectional light or heat or cooling, like a breeze, and where the horse can be for a period of time before you perform the exam, thermography can be very helpful. Again, it doesn't tell you a specific structure, but it tells you a region, somewhat like nuclear scintigraphy. It tells you a region that is warm, and then you need to figure out what structure is involved.
In the warmth, yeah.
Yeah, but certainly
but they don't need to be indoors for a short period of time or in
some sort of controlled environment. Yeah,
controlled environment.
Stall or standing outside is not an appropriate environment to do thermography. So people have tried to use it that way, and it kind of has not been very accurate, and it's hurt thermography as a diagnostic tool because people have said, well, it's too fraught with false negatives and false positives, but that's because it's not being used precisely enough.
Yeah, thank you.
So, yeah, under the right circumstance can certainly be a useful diagnostic tool,
mm-hmm.
at least locate the area that you should pinpoint.
Look at more closely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. MRI has certainly come along as another diagnostic tool, and it can be a very helpful diagnostic tool. The downsides of MRI are expense and the necessity for general anesthesia to use high-field MRI, which is the diagnostic gold standard. Low-field MRI images are not very detailed. So, and the fact that you can only do distal limb, knee and hock down, or in some cases the head and a little bit of the neck. So you can't access quite a bit of the horse using MRI as we know it today.
Okay.
The other problem is that if you have a soft tissue injury, you are going to want sequential exams. You need to, just as if you had a fracture, you would do sequential radiographs to make sure the fracture was healed. You need sequential exams to evaluate soft tissue injuries and to dictate the rehab protocol. And most horses are not going to undergo sequential MRI. So you need a baseline value. I tell people if they're going to get an MRI, they should also get a baseline ultrasound. A lot of the structures that people are saying can't be diagnosed with ultrasound can be diagnosed with ultrasound with a knowledgeable enough ultrasonographer.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the trick, is having someone who's looked at enough ultrasounds of that area to help you with the diagnosis. So there are some areas in the foot and a couple of other areas around the horse's body that MRI can give us added information about. But you get a more global view with MRI. It gives you a view of the whole structure, sort of like radiographs do. But it gives you actually a lower detail view than ultrasound does about the internal architecture of each structure. So the high detail. For detail, you can't beat ultrasound, but you can access some areas that are not accessible by ultrasound with MRI.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some advantages to MRI, particularly in the foot. I think we can see about 85% of what can be wrong in the foot using ultrasound, and the other 15% you need an MRI to diagnose. So, and there's a couple of areas like the stifle, the cruciate ligament. If we find a positive finding in the cruciate ligament and the stifle anterior cruciate, on ultrasound, that's great. If we have a negative finding, that horse may need arthroscopy. We can look at the other seven ligaments of the stifle with ultrasound quite accurately, the menisci, the cartilage, quite accurately for most of the cartilage for the stifle. But that's another example where you need to do something else for a final diagnosis occasionally.
Right.
So those are a few of the limitations of diagnostic ultrasound and what other tools we can use to figure out what's wrong with a horse in those specific cases.
This is a classic case of raw ignorance on my part. You have an ultrasound. My vet has an ultrasound. What's the difference, say, between those two ultrasound machines?
There may be no difference. Quite a few people have, for instance, the identical ultrasound equipment that I have. Ultrasound equipment is like computers. It's morphing so quickly and advancing so quickly that every couple of years the ultrasound machine that you have and love and paid quite a bit of money for is obsolete. So it's a matter of keeping up. And it puts equine veterinarians are an interesting economic group, having had a couple of solo practices and then worked for the university for 12 years and then gone back to solo practice. Equine veterinarians get caught in an interesting squeeze because a lot of equine veterinarians are solo practitioners, and yet they need to have an endoscope and now digital radiography, and what we basically have now is digital ultrasonography, plus all the usual other veterinary paraphernalia and a truck to drive it all around in. And the bottom line there is then the skills to use them all and fit that all into one lifetime and one 24-hour day. The age of specialization is definitely upon us. I think, you know, small animal veterinarians have it much more right. They group into groups. They share the expenses. They often have roving specialists come in. You know, a group of small animal hospitals will contract with a roving surgeon to come in. They have a radiologist read their x-rays for them. They often have an ultrasound person, a roving ultrasound person who comes to the clinic one or two days a week and does ultrasonography for them. So they spread the expense out and they get high-quality diagnostics and or treatment. They often have a medicine specialist come in every week or two and help them with their tough medicine cases. So they've been much more group-minded. I think the equine veterinarian is, you know, the dying breed of rugged individualist, and you know, which has its good qualities, but also makes it a pretty challenging practice lifestyle,
so
financially and as a lifestyle, to be on your own, to be trying to do everything and trying to do all your emergencies and keep up with all of your cases in a good manner is very, very challenging, I think.
Yeah, and I know at least Ann Stewart, our vet, made no bones. She has not looked at enough ultrasounds of, A, her machine probably doesn't necessarily have the same sophistication as yours, B, that she has not developed the skill sets that you've developed to look at all these different areas. And she just doesn't get that many different occasions in her practice.
Right.
To develop
right.
Them. Sort of like the good news and the bad news. And then you get the people like myself who spent the year in denial over the fact that maybe they had a horse that had a problem like this.
Yeah. Well, we're at an awkward spot as far as education. Not a lot of veterinary schools in the country are actually teaching people ultrasound, and it's not for lack of interest. Certainly students are very, very interested. I've gone to a number of veterinary schools since I left UC Davis periodically, including going back to UC Davis periodically, and students are very, veterinary students, you know, it's very high demand to learn ultrasound, but their curriculum is already full. Mm-hmm. From, you know, day one to the very last day of their four-year veterinary education. Money is tight and very, very tight in this economy for buying new equipment. And there's some politics involved that people who are already teaching the curriculum don't want to give up their classes and their courses and their influence for new to teach new information. And Carrie Ridgway runs into the same thing. Chiropractic and acupuncture are very hot topics in veterinary medicine, but they're not being taught at very many veterinary schools. So students, you know, so the veterinarian graduates with very little knowledge in these areas, and they're supposed to somehow acquire this expertise while working full-time. it's a tricky situation.
Not easy. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can really believe that.
So, if there aren't any questions further about this phase, I'll talk a little bit about rehabilitation.
Okay, great.
Yes, please.
Okay. Rehabilitation is actually, although technically I do ultrasound, what I really do is rehabilitation, because the ultrasound is just figuring out the problem. The important thing to do is figure out how to fix it. Very early on, when I first got my first ultrasound machine and was struggling to learn how to use it, I practiced, part of my practice was at a racetrack, and part was a show horse practice. And, of course, bone tendons and suspensory ligament problems are very, very, very common at the racetrack. And a lot of horses would come in from, they would have an injury, and they would be have some stall rest for a month or two or even three, and then they'd be turned out in pasture for somewhere between 8 months and 2 years. And they would come back to the track, and what we would see, the tendon or ligament might feel thickened, but it felt cold and tight, wasn't painful to palpation. The horse would start jogging. He might jog for 60 days, costing his owner maybe $5,000 or $6,000 a month to have him in training. So he'd do 60 days of jogging, and then he'd start to gallop, and his tendon would heat up. Or he might get a little further. He might even get down to 2-minute miles, and then his tendon would heat up. And people go, see, you know, we'd rather have a fracture than a tendon injury. You know, you heal the fracture or you don't. If you heal it, they stay healed. These tendons, we heal them and they put them back to work and they re-injure. And I used to think, that just doesn't make sense to me. If it's healed, it's healed. Why would it re-injure? So I told people at the racetrack that I would ultrasound any horse at no cost if I ultrasounded him before they put tack on him. When he first came back to the racetrack from his layup, his 8 months to 2 years out in pasture, I wanted to ultrasound him. And what I found was those tendons weren't healed. They were big and they were hard, but they didn't have normal appearance. And most importantly, they didn't have parallel fiber alignment. A hallmark of normal strong tendon or ligament is the fibers are aligned parallel. They're aligned along stress lines. So a horse's suspensory ligament, which runs from just below his knee to his fetlock, is loaded in tension from the knee to the fetlock. So those fibers should be absolutely parallel from knee to fetlock. These horses' fibers were random. And they had dark areas in their tendons and ligaments that looked like new injuries, and in fact were new injuries. So what it turned out these horses were doing, because of that short inflammatory phase and long healing phase, they'd be hot and sore and painful, so they'd stand around out in the pasture. And then the inflammatory phase would go by in about 4 weeks, and they'd start running and playing, because after all, these were young thoroughbreds, and they would re-injure. And they would just cycle through that, partial heal, re-injure, partial heal, re-injure. So they weren't healed when they came to the track. It wasn't a re-injury. It was an ongoing injury. And most of these horses were chronic enough that they could stand trotting, but they couldn't stand the act of galloping where the horse bears full weight on one limb at a time. When they'd hit that affected leg and do that for a day or two or a week or two, the partially healed fibers were not strong enough to hold that kind of load, so they'd start to unravel. Now you've got a horse that's been in training for 90 days and has cost the owner another $18,000, and he's not sound, and they're not going to be sound anytime soon. So I started thinking really hard about, okay, what else could we do since this obviously doesn't work? And I started developing a controlled exercise program for these horses, and I had a chance to look at a large number of horses. I was involved in quite a few research studies where we looked at a couple hundred horses at a time and followed them every 4 weeks, which was wonderful because we got to look very, very closely at the tendons and follow them on a very short time frame so we could detect early changes and then keep track of how these horses did when they went back to the races. Racehorses are a great research group because they have very set criteria for performance. They're in a class. They're either a claimer or an allowance horse or a stakes horse, and they're running for a certain person. They're running in a certain company. And either they can finish in the money in those groups or they can't, and their events are timed. So there's a lot of very set criteria for the performance of a racehorse, so you can judge pretty closely whether they're doing the same, better, or worse than they did before. So we started looking at these horses very carefully, and that's when I started to develop my rehab program and really fine-tune it. And in general, the horse needs, with a notable injury, say a moderate injury, it's not a slight injury, not a severe injury, needs about 8 weeks of stall rest and hand walk. Basically, we're resting. We're getting the inflammatory phase over that first 3 to 4 weeks. And we're letting a collagen hyaluronic acid framework be built across the torn fibers so that tendon or ligament collagen can be laid down. And then usually we re-ultrasound at that time, and if the tendon or ligament is improving, we start to ride the horse at a walk. Now, a lot of people say to me, well, is that really more work? It is more work for two reasons. One, horses walk faster than people, and two, the weight of a rider, even a tiny rider, adds significant load to the limbs as each limb is placed on the ground.
Yeah.
So,
Carol, before you get on too further, is this all thinking in terms of leg types of tendons, ligaments, or does this really apply across?
It applies across the board.
Okay. Thank you.
Tendon and ligament tend to heal at the same rate.
Okay.
Wherever they are in the body, with the exception of the extensor tendons, which heal a little more quickly. But flexor tendons and back tendons and ligaments and collateral ligaments, which are all fully weight-bearing ligaments that don't have the aid of the bony column, the extensor tendons are the only exception to this general plan.
So then you start to ride the horse at a walk, and this is even with horses that have back injuries?
Yeah. Almost impossible to be. I either need to sort of give you a very broad general kind of idea, or very specific for go through each type of injury.
Mm-hmm.
Let me do a broad general, which is, you know, kind of gives you a general overview. It's rarely fits any specific horse or specific case, but it gives you an idea of how the healing occurs.
Okay.
And then I'll come back to the back as a specific aside. So, because I want to explain a little bit about why we're doing each of these phases, because during that second healing phase, the 8 to 16-week phase, the horse is putting type 3 collagen into the tendon or ligament. The tendon or ligament is normally type 1 collagen, but that's very slowly formed, and the system recognizes that there's a defect, and it wants to fill it and have some strength. So initially, type 3 collagen is put into the gap. It has some holding strength, but not full holding strength, but it will hold the horse going around at a walk. So then we recheck. We gradually increase the walk time. And if certain criteria are met, the tendon or ligament has come down in size, the core lesion, if there was one initially, has filled in with at least this type 3 collagen. Some form of tissue is evident within the tear, and the horse is comfortable, then we start trot. And what's happening during this phase, which is now the 16 to 24-week phase, is we start tearing out the type 3 collagen and putting in type 1 collagen. So what we're doing with the trot is we're telling that collagen to align along stress lines. Remember, I was talking about how important it is for those fibers to line up along tension lines. So we're putting tension, but the trot is a nice, safe, even gait, and we do this on even ground. The horse is getting no turnout. He's not choosing his exercise. He's not galloping. He's in confinement, or he's walking and trotting in a controlled way. Those are his two choices for his day. This is healing time, not normal horse lifetime. This is injury healing time. So he does his trot work for 8 weeks. Then we're at the 24-week phase. And again, we want to see the tendon stable for size. We want to see no evidence of any new tears. We want to see the tear becoming brighter and the fibers aligning along stress lines so that we know we're laying down type 1 collagen. And then we usually start to canter the horse at that phase, or we increase trot time depending on his job. And a lot of endurance people want to trot more, so we add trot time. And that allow, that 24 to 32 weeks is when we finish laying down, for the most part, type 1 collagen and align along stress lines, and then do the final step, which is cross-linking each new fiber to the next fiber, so that instead of acting as individual fibers, which could shear past each other, they act as a unit, which gives exponentially increases the strength of the tendon or ligament. So those are the phases, and this is why it's very hard to get a tendon or ligament healed sufficiently to withstand full work before 8 months, no matter what we do to it. And some serious injuries can take up to 14 months, but the average injury takes about 8 months to heal. What happens with the more serious injuries is they spend more time at each phase, or an injury that for whatever reason is not healing appropriately spends longer at each phase. If a horse is lame somewhere else and that hasn't been detected and appropriately treated, even though the horse is following a good rehab program, his tendon or ligament won't look good on each sequential ultrasound because he's got a sore hock, so he's overloading his left front suspensory, so it's not healing properly. Or he's got sore front feet, so he's overloading his back, so his back ligament isn't healing properly. So there's a lot of fine-tuning, but that just gives you a general overview. Now, for specific injuries, for instance, a back, we might pony the horse instead of having a rider up in that 8 to 16-week phase, or for quite a bit of it, maybe the last 2 weeks of that phase, we would have a rider up, but early on we would do some other form of exercise. Ponying is a good form. The free exercises are excellent for that kind of exercise. If we need to do rider up because the horse can't be ponied or there isn't a pony horse around to pony him or no free exerciser, we'll often ride him every other day to allow to have a more conservative rehab program and allow those back ligaments to heal. So every injury requires some fine-tuning. That answered your back question a bit.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wrestling with maybe too many options. going back to your question of the thoroughbreds running and getting re-injured, what was your thinking? That how far along had they gotten? Basically, were they laying down basically a type 3 collagen and never got to the type 1 phase at all? Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they never had the appearance that they were putting down type 1 collagen. Or the furthest they would get along would be some partial type 1 and partial type 3.
Okay.
One of the, thinking about the back injury question, when we'd ponied, actually Jake, the one who's going under rehab now, one of the problems with ponying him, this wasn't, this was just, we observed because we occasionally will pony our horses, particularly if you're going at a good moving trot, is, he would get very inverted, he'd get excited or want to be competitive with the other horse, or worse, he'd want to bite, the rascal. The head of the herd, he knew when the head of the herd was being ridden, couldn't bite him back, right? So he'd bite the head of the herd if he's being ponied from the head of the herd.
Right. There are a lot of caveats to ponying. The horse has to be a horse that you
can keep
straight.
At least when you're on his back, you can keep him in a proper frame.
Exactly. Yep. You've got to have the appropriate situation for Pony, or else it's not a good idea.
Okay. The
and the other question I was thinking, on the hand walking, I mean, we've been doing power walking and stuff like that. When, if ever, does it become appropriate to maybe do what you might call work in hand, as in maybe some laterals or something like that, or is that just what you might call extracurricular activity that doesn't qualify as walking?
Doing some just general groundwork and asking the horse to move away and
yeah.
that sort of lateral work.
Yeah, like,
it can,
like,
and it depends on the injury. Horses that have injuries that are on midline, for instance, a bowed tendon, I'll do lateral work with a lot earlier than a horse with a collateral ligament injury or an injury that is going to be stressed by lateral motion. You know, an injury on the side of the limb, for instance, a suspensory ligament branch. I'll do lateral work a lot later with that horse than I will with a horse that has a midline injury. Back injuries, again, if the horse will do lateral work in a relaxed way, great. If they want to skitter sideways and cross one hind limb over the other excessively, that's probably too much work in the early stages for a healing back ligament injury. So more big easy circles, some bending exercises. But you can ask the horse to do some of that. I think you have to be careful about, you know, what's becoming very, very popular right now is core exercises. Very common and very popular with people, and also extending to horses. But you have to be careful with that, with a back injury, asking the horse to go through a wide range of motion of flexing and extending is probably inappropriate with a healing back injury, at least until very late in the healing program.
And then the other thing, given that we live in mountains, is hills. Where, if ever, did they fit in this process?
Hills again, go very, very late in the rehab process. Horses evolved as plains animals. They're sort of a flat or gentle rolling hill meant to be animal. They're a heavy-bodied animal. They're a single-hoofed animal. They've got a long neck and a heavy head, which can really help them with leverage. They're really animals that were... that are geared to move forward quickly or perform all the athletic endeavors that we ask of them, but they're not really very particularly well suited to hill work. Endurance is one of the few sports where we ask horses for extended hill work. Event horses definitely do hill work, but and some of those can be fairly steep obstacles, but they're a very short duration. Almost, you know, a jump or a short incline decline, whereas the endurance horses spend a lot of their time on unlevel ground, so they certainly need to train for that. But because the horse is not naturally very well adapted to that kind of work, it needs to be when the horse's tendons or ligaments are almost back to full strength. And I've had some direct experience with this because horses that are kept in even a small paddock stall on a slope don't heal well. It doesn't matter what their injury is, whether it's a back or a hind suspensory or a forelimb tendon or a pastern injury. Just the act of having to live on that slope dramatically adversely affects their healing.
Mm.
So
that is good.
Let me ask, you've raised a related question on my mind. Because we're endurance riders, we very intentionally selected the place where we wanted to live to be on the mountains, you know, so we could do the cardiovascular training up the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
We like to say when they can go up the 2,000-foot climb with trotting and galloping without a rest, they're ready to go.
Right.
But the other thing we've done, maybe by Don Locker, because we've had to work, you know, all week, is we only do that about once a week. What is, for training, you know, is there a, you know, like for muscle training, so the rule of thumb, particularly for people, is you want to train one day and then take a day off, you know, for strength training.
Right.
You know, and I've heard, but I don't know, that for ligaments and tendons, you actually need more time for that training response. Is there good guidelines on, you know, if you do a hard workout, how long you should wait before you do another one so that you get a training response and not a breakdown in the tendons and ligaments?
Right. There are people doing research on that, and there are some early results on that. But another roundabout way to answer that question is actually horses are amazing cardiovascular responders. They can increase their heart rate by 6 times, their respiratory rate by 4 to 6 times. They have enormous hearts that, you know, are tremendously forceful pumpers of blood. They have enormous lungs. You know, the horse's lung goes back, you know, from right at the level of their forelimb to their loins. I mean, they're just gigantic. So their cardiovascular system is actually less in need of conditioning than their musculoskeletal system. And the musculoskeletal system not only needs more conditioning, but responds more slowly to conditioning. And so really, the musculoskeletal system is the rate-limiting factor in conditioning a horse, not the cardiovascular system. A musculoskeletal system, what we feel we figured out so far is that you need about 4 days a week of some form of conditioning, so that every other day off for response certainly holds true. And that conditioning can be, you know, trotting work is great conditioning. Doesn't have to be seriously strenuous. You might do your one seriously strenuous ride a week, then the next day would be a day off for the horse. But the next day after that, you do your 15 to 20 minute walk warm up and do some trotting. And doing that several days a week in between your strenuous rides will promote bone mass, promote tendon and ligament strength and adaptation, promote muscle strength and adaptation without causing undue wear and tear on the horse's joints or soft tissues. So I think you mentioned when you were here for your exams that you do some dressage work, and I think that's excellent cross-training for flexibility, for strength, for just another outing, another day of exercise, something slightly different, certainly for obedience, for flexibility, all good characteristics in any kind of performance horse.
Okay, good. That's useful. And you say also it's an area where we're really trying to learn, and we're fairly early on, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
I want to go back briefly to the 8 to 16 week phase where you're walking. Are we talking there about what's the quality of the walk that you're looking for there?
I usually tell people to vary it, actually, to keep the horse's attention, because walking, you know, letting the horse walk around on the buckle while you listen to an iPod or do something else is a good way to get lunch by a horse who's being confined otherwise. So I tell people to vary pace and collection at each phase, you know, whatever gait we're doing. So I want the horse to, and during that 8 week phase, you want to start out simple and easy and make it more difficult. Matter of fact, if you visualize your whole rehab program, you're going to start out at a very low level rest, and you're aiming toward a peak, which is return to full work. And the ascent from rest to full work should be as smooth as possible. The more it looks like an ECG, the less success rate you're going to have. So you want a smooth, gradual increase in work and exercise level. And so that means at each phase, when you're hand walking, you start out with a little bit of hand walking, and you end up with more. When you're riding at a walk, you start out easy, let the horse pick their stance quite a bit, and then over time, you not only add more walk time, but you start asking the horse. You pick up the reins, you ask him to collect, you ask him to bend, you ask for more walk halt transitions, because that's a fair amount of work for their hindquarters. So within each within each block of exercise, you're ascending from the lower left-hand corner to the upper right, if you will, if you're thinking of a graph. In difficulty,
where what you might call long and low versus collection sort of fits in the spectrum, because you can do. One of our horses has a fantastic swingy walk, and he can do it long and low, and it just everything. You can almost feel all his body structures move underneath you.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And at the same time, is that where you want to be starting with a rehab, or do you want something which is more finite?
Yeah. You want to just think about where your specific injury is and make it easy at the beginning of the rehab.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't want such an extreme long and low that you're really stretching the horse's back if you have a back injury.
Mm-hmm.
The horse chooses that because it feels good to them, that bears a little more weight. But I've rehabbed 7 or 8 horses myself over the years, usually horses that the owner threw up their hands and it was such a cute horse. And the owner was saying, I'm not doing this. I'm just going to chuck this horse on the trash heap. And I would say, oh, all right, he can stay here. And I'd rehab him and then usually find him another home. Although a couple of them are still here. I learned, you know, and those horses taught me a lot as well. Just doing this personally with different personality type of horses with different injuries. I usually let them pick their pace initially as long as it isn't whoa when I'm walking. And then over time I ask them more and more for what I have in mind.
Okay. So it's more let them stance themselves and...
Right, to an extent. I mean, if you've got such a goer and such a pusher that he's charging and power walking and ready to break into a trot all the time, that's the other extreme, which wouldn't be what you would want. You know, you want a fairly relaxed, reasonable walk, not a panicky, rushing, pushing kind of a walk either. You know, you want something that's a reasonable, medium-paced walk. But if a horse wants to choose his frame as a little bit long and low, that's fine.
Let's make sure other people get to ask questions. Rick, do you have specific questions?
He may have bleeped off. Somebody did.
Yeah, somebody did drop. It may have been Rick.
Okay, how about John?
John's here. The suggestions on the training were just terrific for me. I'm wondering, assuming the horse is not injured, what kind of time frame would you expect the musculoskeletal system to be in a reasonably good shape? I mean, it's kind of hard to evaluate progress, I guess. I've heard things that, you know, you really need to work over 2 or 3 years to get it where you want it, and then you read about, you know, with 2 months off, you know, you've backed down and you have to start over again. And
a good rule of thumb is it generally, you know, if the horse has 2 months off, you're going to spend 2 months getting back to where you were.
Okay.
And that's actually a fairly effective rule of thumb. So, you know, if you know your baseline, every horse's baseline is so individual. It's, again, this is the art and science of training and conditioning, is accurately assessing, cold-bloodedly assessing where your horse is as far as fitness on day one, and then working toward where you want to go. I think the most successful competitors, conditioners, trainers I've associated with over the years tend to be very goal-oriented. They pick their events where they're planning to compete. They're very good at assessing their horse's fitness, and then they make a plan that's a very long-term, far-ahead plan to get incrementally from where they are at that moment to where they want to be, peak, let the horse rest after that event, and then start working toward the next peak. Rather than sustaining a certain level all the time, they let, you know, they push the horse up to that peak within his limits to be successful, but push, and then relax, let the horse relax a bit, and then push back toward another peak.
Yep.
And those horses tend to perform better and last longer than horses that are kind of kept near the peak all the time. And I think actually, as endurance competitors, you guys are better at this than most of the other athletic equine athletes that I deal with, at picking your spots and conditioning up to them.
Is it fair to say, though, that as a horse trains, you know, through year one, year two, year three, that they're not, as they have an off season and they come back for the next season, they wouldn't necessarily fall back as far? And
No, I think you're going to pick up where you left off at the end of
right.
the last season
okay.
more, rather than go backwards. As long as the horse is healthy and sound, that rest period is just going to take you back for that time frame.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Good.
Following up on John's question, I mean, any, you know, traditionally, you know, we don't let horses do, well, not traditionally, just the rules of the sport. They can do an LD when they're four. They can't do a full endurance ride, you know, 50 miles till they're five. A lot of people like to wait till they're even seven or eight to do 100. Others, ourselves included, have tended to move them up to 100 when they're a long six or early seven, you know, and keep the speed down. Any sort of good, you know, ideas on, you know, what is the right rate of progression given, you know, every horse is different and you have to develop,
yeah.
you know, evaluate their athletic capabilities, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera.
Sure. I think most horses are not full adults until they're seven, physically or mentally. So I think that, you know, that would be the first time frame where you would ask for maximum performance would be when the horse is seven or eight, depending on, you know, how competitive you were being with that maximum level. So your time frame sound reasonable to me. Especially, I think endurance Arabians are a little bit more slow maturers, but even the so-called fast maturing breeds, the thoroughbreds, really, really, if you look at those horses, they're changing until they're 7 years old. You know, they may have technically reached their maturity at three, but when you watch them, their body shape changes so much from three to seven, and they gain so much strength, and often they'll even actually grow and be taller from between three or four and seven. I think they're still in a state of flux, and they're certainly mentally not mature until they're seven, for the most part.
I've got a horse that if he's mature mentally and he's 8 years old,
yeah.
I want them to be more mature mentally.
Well, then there are the ones who just never seem to grow up, just like a few people. but most horses, let's put it this way, they're as mature as they're going to get usually by about seven. From there on, you know, they may gain some wisdom, but you've kind of got the adult personality that you're going to be stuck with at seven.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think super finely matured when it's about 15 now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they do gain the wisdom. They do get more educated.
Yeah, they definitely.
And do all of that.
Part of it is it takes the riders that long to gain wisdom.
To figure out what to do with the horse, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But that's interesting because the one horse that we did bring along quickly probably was an unusually early maturing horse because he quit growing when he was four.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he was 14-1 when we got him, and he just turned four, and the owner assured us, you know, he would mature out at close to 15, and I don't think he ever grew another 16th of an inch.
Yeah.
So he was probably an atypically early maturing horse.
Yeah.
He thought he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, he figured he was a grown-up by then, huh?
Yep.
Yeah.
Anne?
Hey, I'm here.
Any questions from your end?
One more question, I guess, and I don't know if this is your area of expertise or not, but you seem to read and hear a lot lately about red light therapy.
Yeah.
Any generalizations about that in terms of effectiveness, or are they still experimenting a lot with it?
There is quite a bit of experimentation, but not a lot of conclusion as yet. As in general, light, all the light, you know, various light modalities are for pretty shallow tissue. So that's a bit of a limiting factor in horses. Certainly, some of the injuries we deal with are shallow tissues, but a lot of them are further, have just enough depth that they're not in good light therapy type of range. So that's been the limiting factor. Actually, you know, light therapy has, in general, been more effective on dogs than on horses, just because you're dealing with a tiny patient, relatively speaking.
Okay.
But I think it's a good idea to always keep an open mind and keep keep current on what's happening. So that when, because we do find new uses and new ways to tweak modalities that let us use them more effectively. And for horses, we're always battling patient size with the horse.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff that's developed for people, you know, the small animal guys cash in on because they just use the pediatric version of the human product or human treatment modality in their set, because, you know, the 30-pound dog is like a pediatric patient. But trying to escalate up from the 150-pound standard human to the 1,000-pound standard horse is a little trickier.
Mm-hmm. I can see why.
But, you know, not to say we shouldn't be aware of developments and try these
things.
But that is one of our big challenges, to try to escalate upward.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We should be thankful we're not like Hannibal trying to ride elephants.
Exactly. I've done some ultrasound on elephants. They're fascinating creatures. I think they're wonderful creatures, but their anatomy is certainly challenging.
They're huge. Yeah.
Doing anything with them is just a major undertaking.
I can see.
So yeah, fortunately we're not dealing with that kind of size.
Okay. Let's see if there are any further questions, and if not, give you you know, chance for last words, and then we'll thank you again.
Okay.
Is John or Ann or Carol?
I'm cool. Thank you.
Well, this has been very helpful for me. I certainly appreciate it very much.
Oh, good. Just, I'm very, very glad.
Where are you located, Carol?
In South Carolina.
South Carolina.
Okay. Do you travel at all to do this?
I don't travel to do this. I do travel to lecture, and I teach a number of seminars to veterinarians around the country. But I've developed a practice here, and I'm pretty stuck here when I'm not away lecturing.
Yeah, okay. I that was my impression, but it was one of those classic things. Well, since we've got probably three or four of your patients and within a certain radius here.
Yeah.
John, you got to move down. At least if you move down to our area, you're just a small number of hours away.
Yeah, there you go.
I was going to ask if you have any disciples in Northern Virginia, but...
Not yet. I've just moved to this coast from California in the last year, so I'm just learning the players here.
Well, part of the reason I'm asking is I do have a horse that, which is my horse, sustained a bit of a traumatic injury to her, probably in the lumbosacral area last year. And it probably wasn't very well diagnosed and managed in the rehab. And in fact, I rode a 50 on her in the fall. but it's coming back this year that right now that she may have a bit of a posture problem where she's, you know, kind of sitting back a little bit and causing a lot of soreness in her hind end there a little bit. So we're trying to figure out what to do with all this, and it's a lot of it sounds like we just didn't manage this rehab at all very well, and trying to figure out what to do with it next is, and you know, I've got a chiropractor looking at her, and that's
I think that whole body, you know, figuring out why she's sitting back is going to be critical. And why she's doing that, is it her lumbar area bothering her so she's assuming that posture, or,
well,
you know,
I'm just wondering. Yeah, she's started, she just kind of tucked up a little bit to protect herself last year, and just hasn't. So we're going to put some wedges, 1-degree wedges on her heels and the back, and try to tip her a little bit forward or something. But
yeah, Yeah.
But I'm not convinced we're still doing the right things yet, and that's why I was wondering how close you were.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you find someone there who's doing ultrasound and you'd like, I can certainly look at images and try to help you figure out an appropriate rehab program.
Okay.
So,
well, that's I think I'm going to actively look around for an ultrasound. They may be doing it at the Morven Park up here, which is Virginia Tech.
Yeah. Yeah.
Facility, and I'm going to check there because, you know, you said 8 months, and it's I certainly haven't given her the right 8 months based on what you just said. So.
Yeah.
I don't think we're there yet.
You know, and John, in retrospect, you know, we'll never know for sure with the horse that we're going through rehab whether the sort of traumatic, you know, semi-fall he had in late March was the primary cause or whether it was chronic. But looking back over all the signs and symptoms, I think it was more likely either came with it or it came from repetitive injuries. We went from, you know, 50-mile rides up to 75-mile rides and more mountainous rides, and I think we went through some of what you did of not getting to the bottom of it soon enough, and, you know, now we are trying to do it right, and hopefully
Well, I'm hoping if I can backtrack and do the right thing, we can still correct the issue.
Yeah, the good thing is that tendons and ligament do heal if you provide the right environment and the right sequence of events. Even the chronic injuries will turn around and heal. So that's the good news, is they keep trying.
Well, then I need to get the correct diagnosis here so we can focus on this. But that's very helpful. So.
Good.
Personally, understanding that, I went off a horse 8 or 9 weeks ago and strained a ligament on my hamstring and adductor, and it's 8 or 9 weeks, and now I'm finally back in the saddle, but it's certainly not better. So,
yeah,
I hate all this.
You know, see, I think I think that equine veterinarians are actually on the cutting edge of rehab. We've just, after 5 years, gotten a new board specialty in veterinary medicine approved by the American Veterinary Medical Association, and it's a new specialty in sports medicine for veterinarians. And I, you know, having met with this group for 5 years, working on getting this established, I think that a lot of animals are getting more sequential, controlled exercise, thought out, cohesive, coherent rehab programs than a lot of human athletes are. When I was at UC Davis, there are a lot of triathletes in Davis, because as one of them said on television, there's nothing else to do in Davis. But
it's not that bad.
It's not that bad. I spent a lot of years there, but it certainly raised a bunch of feathers, because, you know, a lot of people in Davis are pretty proud of Davis, so they were very huffy over this triathlete statement. But a lot of triathletes pull their Achilles tendons and damage them quite badly. And they'll often have surgery to remove the affected portion, which to me makes zero sense. And then they sort of get 5 to 6 weeks of physical therapy because that's what their insurance pays for. And then they get told to do whatever doesn't hurt. Well, that's insane. It's like turning the injured horse out in pasture. So these guys would come in, and women would come into the equine ultrasound unit and ask me to scan their Achilles tendon, and they would look like an old, broken-down, bowed tendon racehorse, just awful. They would look like one of these worst-case pasture horses with a big, woody tendon that had pretty much given up trying to heal because it had been re-injured so many times. It had a poor fiber pattern, no parallel alignment, no real strength, lots of type 3 collagen. By inference, I can say type 3 just from looking at so many histo slides and ultrasounds and putting the two together in my head. You know, they were a mess, and they'd be 2 years out from their injury saying, I can't ride my bike for 25 miles without it killing me. I'll never, you know, be able to do 50 miles again. So this is a nascent field, certainly in human medicine as well as in equine medicine. But I think we're the learning curve is starting to get steeper and steeper. We're finding out information and sharing it with each other faster and faster, and that's the good news.
Well, if I can find somebody to do an ultrasound on my horse, they'll have to do my leg too.
Sure, you should.
I've got one additional question that's occurred to me. Everything that you've talked about in rehab is what I would call stuff that you can do yourself, which is great.
Yes.
And at the same time, I know with some broken limbs and stuff like that, you can, you know, plug yourself, at least with humans, you can plug yourself into the wall current and you can use magnetic fields or something rather to stimulate healing or something. I've never broken a limb, thank God. But I know other people who have had their electric wiring run through their casts, so they can do that type of thing, and it sort of cuts the healing time. Is there anything of that nature on some of these guys that would be conceivable, viable, whatever?
We've been looking for something to either improve the quality of tendon healing or speed tendon healing for as long as I've been in practice, and I'm still looking at every new treatment modality, but we have not found anything that really alters either the rate or quality of that process. We're pretty good at anti-inflammatory, that first four-week phase. We're good at modulating the inflammatory response so that there is enough inflammation to get the process of healing going without so much that it causes further damage. So that's a little bit of an art and science, too, because you want a little bit of inflammation, but not too much.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as getting the tendon cells, and I'm saying tendon is tendon and ligament, to lay down that type 3 collagen, chew it out, replace it with type 1, align the fibers and cross-link them, we have not found any treatment modality that appreciably changes the rate or quality of those steps.
Okay.
Hmm.
We're still looking.
No magic bullet pill.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me, on behalf of AFX, heartily thank you. I think this has been tremendously valuable, and I think you'll a lot of the other AFX members will be listening to this, on the audio that we make available. That. Which is one that, unfortunately, you never know how many really listen to it, but we do
right.
A lot of them come back and say, boy, that was great. So we're going to make a hearty recommendation that they do that. And, again, let me thank you. This is very valuable for all of us. And
well, I'm glad. You're very, very welcome.
Indeed.
And I will look forward to seeing our guys soon. We'll
yes. And thank you very much. Really, I will just second what Stag said. It was excellent and very, very helpful on multiple different dimensions.
Yep.
Well, I'm glad. Good. You're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Good night all, and thank you all.
Good night.
Bye.
Thanks, Ray. Bye.